This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
Welcome to another edition of Radioactive Magazine on KKFI with Dave Mitchell. We are privileged to have as our guest Mr. Dennis Weiser, who is an author of both fiction and nonfiction books, as well as poetry, having published a dozen works since 2005. He earned his BA in liberal arts from Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri. Dennis took every philosophy and creative writing class available. He includes some Westminster professors as significant mentors in his development. He earned his master's in philosophy from the University of Kansas in 1991, writing a 200-page thesis on Hannah Arendt. His writings have appeared in The Legendary, Truth Out, and several anthologies from Outrider Press. He has been a regular columnist for the Kansas City Business Journal and book reviewer for the NPR affiliate KCUR. He has been a member of the Tallgrass Writers Guild, The Writer's Place, and the Academy of American Poets. He is the author of Plum Skullduggery, A Satire of American Exceptionalism, New Institutes, A Primer of Practical Theology for 21st Century America, and the three-volume Sinister Dynamic, Global Governance, and the Reconstruction of Nature. He has just completed his third novel, The Soul Snatcher of Java. This summer, I attended a UMKC Community University course sponsored by Dennis on writer publishing. In following conversation, Dennis provided me with his book, New Institutes, A Primer of Practical Theology for 21st Century America. In reading this book, I perceive Dennis to be an astute cultural observer. I have invited him onto Radioactive Magazine to share his observations on America's cultural condition and how these conditions relate to the 2016 election and the elevation of Donald Trump to president-elect. Dennis, welcome to Radioactive Magazine.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
To start off, I would like to read a few quotes from your book, New Institutes. Quote, America is, once again, at the very crossroads of her cultural being. While the nation aspires to worship a god who jealously forbids graven images, it slavishly serves an advertising culture conditioned by a panoply of sensuous visual idols. And, quote, betrayal of our sacred political principles by a majority of individual citizens represents a perilous abdication of moral and political responsibility, one that poses a dire threat to this republic, written in 2015. Can you expand on these themes and what the linkages are with the dynamics of the 2016 election?
Well, sure. Remember, it's the economy, stupid. Republicans never got over Bill Clinton's 1992 victory, which killed George H.W. Bush's shot at a second term. Trump took advantage of the obsession with economics, the economy, jobs, and employment. And we'll get to that in a little bit. But in order to understand what happened, we really need to look at the religious heritage from the 17th century and 18th century, and then the 19th century, the ideology of the 19th century. Puritanism in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, it's really Calvinism, it's Protestantism, so this has to do with the Protestant Reformation. The Puritans came here with the intention of establishing a religious utopia, but wound up creating a materialistic society instead. Puritans in colonial America, however, had inherited a softened version of Calvinism. This original Calvinism was stark. God's all-powerful, man has no free will except what conforms to the will of God, period. But once they got to America and the frontier, things started to change because they had other pressures environmentally, like the next generation that didn't have any idea what had happened in Europe or the crossing of the Atlantic or the Arabella or any of that. So they decided to come up with a soft version of the theology, the Calvinism, and this was the covenant. In other words, man covenants. He makes a contract with God, and if he keeps up his end of the bargain, God will guarantee salvation, basically. As historian Perry Miller said, this is a way of extorting salvation from God. And you can see that the covenant of grace, this kind of covenant theory, it's very close to the enshrining of contracts later on in the economic development of the country in the 18th and 19th century. Okay, so we come to the 19th century. The 19th century was utterly obsessed by a monolithic conception of positivist science. Science often opposed to, even while identifying itself with religious mission, not just here in this country, but worldwide. The ideology that dominated 19th century worshipped the higher powers of science, human manipulation of the cosmos by unlocking its universal principles of operation, and then changing the world by permanently from within according to its own system of rules, hubris of expanding free will, a la Hugo Gernsback's whatever a man wills, he can do, and a belief in infinite progress. Now, and, these were all doctrinal. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. And all this sort of ties into American exceptionalism.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. These are all doctrinal legacies of the 19th century. The fact that they are also the fundamental assumptions of classic science fiction of the first half of the 20th century incontrovertibly prove that these notions are completely bogus. And let me just go through some of them. The ideology of the 19th century can be reduced to seven basic notions. One, expansive free will. Two, boundless optimism about the future. Three, technological salvation. Four, the necessity of working for money. Five, the intrinsic dignity of working for money. Six, unlimited progress. Now, taking those together, they appear to justify belief in the seventh notion, American exceptionalism, the idea that God has ordained America to rule the world. The reason that they cannot do that is that all seven notions are demonstrably false. Well, Nonetheless, that didn't keep James Walker in 1852 from saying power is human will. Okay, so that's the condition of the 19th century, the first half of the 19th century, by the way, leading up to the Civil War. Well, we've abandoned our heritage of revolutionary politics and political action. The founding fathers, Jefferson, Adams, Franklin, Washington, could take for granted vibrant local political engagement because that had been the people's experience for 150 years. Even so, when Franklin was asked what kind of government had the Constitutional Convention given the people, he said, "A republic, if you can keep it." Well, we have not kept. So what is this political freedom and political experience we've turned our back on? All right. Hannah Arendt wrote a book in 1963 called On Revolution. A little bit of background about her. She was a German-Jewish refugee who left Germany at the age of 26 in 1933 when Hitler came to power. She went to Paris in 1933 and worked for Youth Aliyah, rescuing Jewish children from Eastern Europe and getting them into Palestine safely. A lot of it was fundraising as well as logistics. In 1941, she moved to New York, where a decade later, and she was a stateless person for 18 years, but from 1941 to 51, when she became a U.S. citizen, she studied our Constitution and all of our sacred political documents, Jefferson's letters, Adams' writings, the Federalist Papers, that sort of thing. And what she came up with was a comparative study of the French, Russian, and American revolutions in the 1963 book On Revolution. Now, political freedom in general, and this is a quote from Hannah Arendt, "Political freedom in general is the right to participate in governance, or it is nothing." Okay, all political authority is hierarchical, according to Arendt. It's either comes from the top down, from a king or a tyrant, or in our case, a completely corporatized governmental system. Or political authority can arise from the grassroots, from the masses. She uses the model of a pyramid with power at the top of the king or the government or whoever, tyrant, and then at the bottom is the masses, the mob, the workers, however you want to describe them. And in between is every different level and strata of education, status, wealth, whatever, talent. Now, Arendt says, so you've got those two ways, top-down authority, political authority, or from the bottom up. But I would point out that every grassroots movement has always been, in American history, has always been co-opted by corporations from the 19th century on. Well, she says there's one other way to produce a political elite, and that is to have them self-chosen from among their peers. And here we get to the essence of her account. Freedom is impossible. Freedom is only possible, that is, among equals, political and moral equals. The source of our political and moral equality, and we have to clarify equality, because it only occurs in a political space where freedom exists. When the basis of our political and moral equality is the fact that our natality, the fact that we're born into this world, and our mortality, the fact that we all die one day and don't really can't predict when. Now, when citizens come together as political and moral equals, respecting each other's dignity and opinions, a space is created in which freedom is experienced as a tangible reality. In that space, Political passions, genuine political passions or virtues, can be recognized by the participants. What are these virtues? Well, Arendt lists them all in the last 12 pages of On Revolution. Courage, the pursuit of public happiness, the taste of public freedom, an ambition that strives for excellence, regardless of not only of social status and administrative office, but even of achievement and congratulation. Now, to those, I would add impartiality, empathy, compassion, personal honesty, trustworthiness, and a sense of justice or fairness. These are the key virtues and passions participants should eagerly strive to recognize among their peers in the course of open discussion and opinion formation. Because those are the people, the best, as she says, and they should have an appropriate place and role in governing. So, now, equality, it's not a universally valid principle. Neither is political authority. They only exist when that space exists. So let's consider 2011, the Occupy movement. It actually confirmed Arendt's account of political freedom as spatial. They thought it was about jobs, for a very good reason. A lot of them were unemployed. And in a capitalist system without money, you're don't exist. You have no soul. Okay, they thought it was about jobs. It was never about jobs. It was always about freedom. They were there as equals. They accepted each other as equals. They didn't know what they'd created. They created a space where they experienced genuine freedom, from Zuccotti Park in New York, to Oakland, California, and a lot of other towns and cities in between. They didn't know what it was that they'd created, and they didn't know what to do with it. This is partly because, largely because, the right has so demonized politics, political experience, and government in all of its cognate forms that you can hardly use the word without having, horrible connotations. So they've been very effective about that. It's has always been about freedom, political freedom. In 1945, Hannah Arendt observed, each time society through unemployment frustrates the small man in his normal functioning and normal self-respect, it trains him for that last stage in which he will willingly undertake any function, even that of hangman. Now, she had witnessed the demise of the Weimar Republic and the rise of Nazism, but she was astute enough to warn her PhD doctoral advisor and mentor, Karl Jaspers, who happened to be married to a Jewish woman named Gertrude, that, he should get out of thinking about leaving Germany. Can't you smell the coffee, she said, in effect. And he said, Hannah, this Nazi thing will blow over in a couple of years. Don't worry about it. Well, the Jaspers were scheduled for deportation to Auschwitz. Fortunately, the Allies arrived earlier than expected in April of 1945, and they were spared. Okay, so equality is not a universally valid principle. It only exists as long as that space in which freedom is experienced by participants who are moral and political equals.
Okay. Dennis, that gets right to the – so basically what you're saying is that, as I understand it, is that the system that we have now is not really a – it's not a democracy in this sense at all. It's a democracy it's ruled more by increasingly ruled more by mob psychology and emotion rather than informed citizens. And, I think
Well, we don't have a democracy. We haven't had a democracy with a few exceptions, the abolition movement, the civil rights movement in the post-World War II era, the student protest against the Vietnam War, feminism, the feminist movement, and the gay rights movement. Those are exceptions.
Those movements all had a profound effect on society.
Absolutely.
And a very positive effect on society.
Sure. I should qualify my statement about grassroots always being co-opted by government. They do eventually get co-opted, but during the Depression, the farmers' revolt all through the Midwest led directly to FDR saving capitalism because he went to the really wealthy moguls and said, you're going to give me a lot of money so I can help these people. Otherwise, you're going to have to deal with socialists and communists, and they're not going to give you as good a deal as I'll give you. And that's from Richard Wolff. He's absolutely right, a Marxist, great, wonderful Marxist economist, although I have doubts about his solution being through for more work for everyone.
Yeah. So given the fact that we have such a distorted democracy, you know, there's I'd like to read this quote from this article that I saw in the Huffington Post on the 30th of November of this year. It's called How Autocracy Will Come to America by Michael Brenner, who's a professor of international affairs at the University of Pittsburgh. He writes, "The palatable truth is that authoritarian movements and ideology with fascist overtones are back in America and in Europe, not just as a political expletive thrown at opponents, but as a doctrine, and above all, as a set of feelings." And then this is my statement. I think Donald Trump has definitely tapped into a certain set of feelings among many. I'm not so sure about any defined ideology on his part.
Right.
What is your feedback to these observations?
Well, Donald Trump is so unconscious that he doesn't even know he's a fascist. You know, I heard Ben Carson say the other day, yesterday, I believe, on NPR, that government should stop interfering in people's lives, he's thinking of. And then there was somebody, one of the Republican delegates to the Republican convention, said that, condemning Hillary by saying that, well, at least Trump's a businessman, he knows business, and he's not one of these elitists like one of these elite people like Hillary Clinton. Well, this guy was a millionaire. His father gave him $1 million. He blew it. He's been bankrupt more than once. You know, this business thing, this reminds me of the Lee Iacocca. Everybody was talking about Lee Iacocca should be president, the guy that brought us the Ford Pinto scandal and really ruined Ford, which is why he had to go to Chrysler. Businessmen have been running things for 400 years or more, and they've just about run the planet into the ground. So, you know, business expertise. And this, again, is that legacy from the 19th century that says science is everything. It's going to solve our problems, except that by science they mean applied science or technology. In the 19th century, the electric dynamo, steam engines, the railroads, factory cities.
Yeah, there
transatlantic
is.
Cable, Morse code, and
there is that dream of sort of creating a paradise on Earth through
that's technological salvation.
That's what's destroying the planet for sure.
Let me read. This is from Perry Miller. It's from an essay. He says, take the first decades of this republic as your testing ground. As a matter of fact, you can also take subsequent ones. And you will find that you must locate the tension between religion and freedom of the mind, not amid the multitudinous jarring sects, but between two definable extremes. On the one hand, there's a biblicist and ineradicably revivalistic piety, saying with Thomas Campbell, where the scriptures speak, we speak. Where the scriptures are silent, we are silent. On the other hand, there is a naturalism more or less spiritualized, becoming, if anything, more appealing to large numbers of Americans when, with the help of Darwin, nature was found not so much to thunder the Ten Commandments as positively to yodel the gospel of wealth. Okay, and the gospel of wealth is another one of those historians' terms for, you know, a trend, a preoccupation, an ideological preoccupation. And that's the one that we've suffered from in the 20th century. The technologies have changed. The innovations have changed dramatically. And they changed in the second half of the 19th century. But in this 20th century, they were transformed even more. So we're not, you know, throwing a party about railroads and factory cities and steam engines and the transatlantic cable. But we've got the internet, we've got smartphones, we've got...
But the underlying dynamic is still the same.
Exactly the same. And the ideology is the same. All seven of those components. Future, you know, onward and upward, things are getting better.
And so there's really the need for... there's a need to move away from this dynamic to a new way of looking at things.
Oh, exactly. Whether we call them, with Jefferson, elementary republics, the Paris communes, German Räte, or Russian Soviets, all refer to what Arendt terms the council system. It's that political system that I described, of people coming together as moral and political equals to create a space of freedom. And it's arisen spontaneously. Citizens at the local level in every revolution from the 18th through the 21st century, which were ignored by revolutionary party leaders and the state, or else regarded as temporary transitional movements. They are rather, as Hannah Arendt described them in On Revolution, an entirely new form of government with a new public space for freedom, which was constituted and organized during the course of the revolution itself. And that's the tradition, the heritage of revolutionary politics and political action that we have abandoned. Not only has a virulently corporatist ideology invaded every sphere of our lives, from business, childcare, and education, to media, scientific research, and worship, it has weakened our collective grip on moral values and distinctions, thoroughly corrupted our political and cultural life, and undermined a system of public education that was once the pride and measure of our democracy. That it was not equally available to minorities is an abominable administrative and political failure, but it is no argument against the curricular content of that educational system. Political action, political freedom is different than physical strength, brute force, and violence. It appears only when equals share their honest opinions in open discussion and debate to arrive at a decision to act.
Well, Dennis, how do we, given the invasion of, given the circumstances of certain ideology and corporate corporate media and control of government in a lot of ways, how do we at this point in time pull back from that and begin to claim our own power as citizens? Where do we start?
Well, presently there is no public space in our local communities where citizens can meet regularly as equals and experience the freedom created by genuine politics. This and a common language are critical requirements for achieving autonomous local democracy. And I might also add that, the possibilities for doing this look bleak, but the short answer is people in local communities, citizens, some portion of them are going to have to organize locally.
Well, I could see that personally. I could see that happening as things begin to break down. I can see a situation where our ecosphere begins not to be able to support us because of the way we're behaving as a species, and then there will be increasing breakdown of a number of things, including.
Right.
And in that process of breakdown, I can see people will, I think, respond by organizing much more locally. And
right.
I kind of, outside of that scenario, I'm not sure I see us being able to
I've asked myself
create locally
a lot. What would be the equivalent in modern America of Gandhi's march to the sea to make salt from seawater in violation of the British patent? The British government supposedly was the only one that could make salt.
Right.
Well, 10,000 people followed him down to the ocean, for starters, and he got arrested. Okay. Now, what could, say, a public-minded citizen do that would be the equivalent of that? And, since I think profit maximization is driving the whole capitalist economic system, I think burning $10,000 down in the lobby of the Fed would be a good start. You get it videotaped and get arrested, and go to jail.
Well, the thing about Gandhi is that he had unshakable moral conviction, and he had extremely high virtue in a number of ways, and he was recognized for that.
He had a connection with the people. He's a religious leader, and it's India.
I think when you talk about the invasion of corporate ideology into all segments of society, people feel that loss.
Right.
They feel that loss. They feel that loss of morality, that loss of what was the other phrase? People feel that things are really beginning to be beyond their grasp.
But all they can point to and complain about is government.
Uh-huh.
Well, how come these people aren't saying how corporate power, multinational and transnational corporations, have been warping their entire civil society and doing that invasion? Of course, the corporations and this definition is from Jean Le Carre, the great spy novelist, who also worked for MI5 and MI6 during the 50s and 60s. But he was paraphrasing Mussolini, who presumably knew what fascism was. What fascism is, And he said, when you can't get a cigarette paper between corporate power and government, that's fascism. Now, that's why I say Donald Trump is so unconscious he doesn't even know he's a fascist. But that's what we're dealing with.
Well, he's very much hand in glove with corporate power in America, for sure.
He is the elite. He represents the corporate elite.
Yeah, he's way above the 1%.
Now, oligarchs and vested interests finance the war industry, entrenched stratified classes will do everything they can to subvert, co-opt, or destroy genuine political movement. Corporations will argue that this proposed plan of local community organizing or neighborhood-by-neighborhood organizing is hopelessly naive and idealistic. Okay. That's what they'll say.
Okay.
It could never work, violates human nature, is an affront to God's plan of universal order, is un-American, et cetera, ad nauseum. And that they and they alone can achieve the goals attributed to this program of detaching the profit motive from universal credit, because that's where we're going to have to go. But we'll have to save that for another.
That's a tall order.
Yeah.
Well, Dennis, we are out of time for this segment. Thank you very much for being on Radioactive Magazine. Very much appreciate it.
Okay, I want to thank David Mitchell for that great interview, and thank you, Dennis, as well. This is Bill Claus, Radioactive Magazine. We have a few minutes here, so I wanted to mention some upcoming events that we're going to be doing. The public affairs side of KKFI has some really exciting things coming up. You know, I was down here during the election, broadcasting during the election, excited about the fact that, at least I thought, I was getting a chance to vote for the first woman president of the United States, and like a lot of other people, was very surprised at the way things turned out. So I was up late, and when I got up on November the 9th, I had a very strong urge to pull the covers up over my head and stay there for the next 4 years. But we have around here, we've all decided among the public affairs progressive community here at KKFI, it's time to crawl out of bed and get to work. So along that line, we have planned an ambitious schedule for this winter and spring of some live events that we're doing to complement the work that we do on our public affairs radio programs. In January, we're kind of got a tentative date of January 27th, although we're not sure that's the date it'll be. We're planning a gathering of progressives to take a look at the challenges and dangers of the upcoming administration, and we're going to talk about a lot of the issues that a lot of people have some very serious concerns about, such as the fate of climate change, whether which some people consider perhaps the issue of our time. What can we do to help promote a rational immigration policy? It's really unclear what Trump intends to do other than build a wall and deport 11 million people. Seems to have backed away some with that, but we've got to be in there fighting to find out what we can do to support a rational immigration policy. Resist right to work. I think there's a real, it's almost a done deal that right to work is going to pass in Missouri now with the election behind us. You know, I first got involved in the as an activist back in 78 when they were trying to pass the right to work at that time. It was a very exciting time. Organized labor all came together and fought against it. And when the campaign started, 60% of the state was for right to work. But with working together, we ended up defeating it at the end of that campaign. Well, here we are. Now it looks like it's going to be just a matter of legislative fiat. So we're going to be talking about that. Some other events we're going to be having next spring. During the interview you just listened to, there a mention was made of economist Richard Wolff. Well, Rick Wolff is a noted author. One of his books is Democracy at Work, a Cure for Capitalism. He's a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts and is a very popular radio host with a weekly hour-long program, Economic Update, on the Pacific affiliate MBAI in New York City. Anyway, he's a very popular speaker. We plan to bring him to town in March. In April, Communities Creating Opportunities Conference is going to be in Kansas City, and that's a series of events to deal with racial inequality. And KKFI is hoping to have an event there that will feature Dr. Eddie Moore and John Powell, two prominent players in the struggle for racial equality. And then June, July, very exciting. Juan Gonzalez is going to be on a book tour. Juan Gonzalez, of course, one of the co-hosts of Democracy Now! So all listen for all the details of that. So next week on KKFI, we're going to be I'll have an interview with someone from The Whole Person as well as from Moore Squared dealing about racial equality. So stay tuned for Counterspin, and thank you for coming up right after these messages.